everyone. This is Mark Movsesian, and I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. And I'm joined once again by my friend and colleague, the center's other co-director, Mark DiGirolami, for an episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived at our website, lawandreligionforum.com, and also on Apple iTunes and also on Android. Well, Mark, welcome back. It's been a long summer. We haven't done this for a couple months.
I'm looking forward to it. Yes, I missed our podcast, Mark. I'm glad that we're back in action.
Yes, and I know that our listeners have missed it too. So we're glad to be back with all of them. Well, we thought today we might do, the Supreme Court's new term begins in a couple of weeks in October. And so we thought this might be an opportune time to review the Religion Clause cases at the court. First, the cases that were decided last term, and also the cases that are coming up for this term. Do a little, looking back and looking forward kind of thing to get everybody ready for what's coming up. So the first thing we'd like to talk about is last term. And I said Religion Clause cases, but if you set aside the COVID cases, which we've discussed in other podcasts, really there was one big Religion Clause case at the court last year. It was a case called Fulton versus City of Philadelphia, which people anticipated would actually be a major ruling on accommodations under the Free Exercise Clause, and also maybe the court would use this as a vehicle for resolving conflicts between religious freedom and LGBT rights. But in the end, it didn't turn out to be a big, broad case. It was sort of a narrow holding.
Although I guess there's some uncertainty about that, Mark, just exactly what Fulton did and how broad the holding is or isn't. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what the case was about? I think we've probably discussed this case before, so listeners may be familiar with it, but this is a chance to really sort of get into what the court did with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the issue in Fulton was whether the city of Philadelphia could require Catholic Social Services, this is an adoption service, to place children with same-sex couples, notwithstanding CSS's religious objections, as a condition of participating in the city's foster care system. And CSS argued that the requirement violated the Free Exercise Clause. Now, the court ruled unanimously in favor of CSS, but declined the opportunity to overrule a case called Employment Division versus Smith, which was decided 30 years ago, which is what some observers had anticipated or hoped the court might do, because critics think that Smith offers too little protection for religious exercise, and they thought that the court's new membership might decide to overrule the case once and for all. And that didn't happen.
In fact, there were some interesting comments and concurrences by, for example, Justice Barrett, wondering what should replace the Smith test if they were going to go with something else. There was a concurrence by Justice Alito with respect to, which was actually a quite long concurrence that we'll maybe get into, but about why the Smith test ought to be overruled. So this seems to be a matter of some contention on the court.
Yeah, actually the Alito opinion sort of, some people said, I agree with this, sort of reads like it was a majority opinion at one point, and then maybe he lost some votes after conference. But well, what makes Smith so controversial? Why is it so controversial? Smith holds essentially that there's no constitutional right to an exemption to a neutral, generally applicable law that only incidentally burdens religious exercise. Such a law basically doesn't violate the Free Exercise Clause. That's kind of how most people look at Smith. However, even under Smith, a law that is not neutral and generally applicable, that targets religion for disfavored treatment, is subject to something called strict scrutiny, which is a familiar constitutional law test, and it says that a law is constitutional only if the state has a compelling interest and the law is the least restrictive means of achieving that interest. Well, in Fulton, the lower court had held that the city policy was neutral and generally applicable. It said no discrimination across the board, and therefore the lower court said the policy didn't violate the Free Exercise Clause. Because it applied to all adoption agencies regardless of their religious affiliation. So it didn't target religion for unfair treatment.
And actually, Mark, these are somewhat severable components, aren't they? So that there's neutrality, meaning the issue of targeting, and then there's the issue of general applicability, which actually, I think in this case, that was supposed to be the Waterloo for the Smith test, right?
Yeah, you're right. You're right, Mark. These are, I sort of run them together in my mind, because I think the way I look at it, even general applicability sort of looks like a targeting thing. If the statute only applies to religion, then it kind of looks like targeting. But I concede, you know, you have a, your understanding is another acceptable understanding. People disagree about this, Mark.
You could call it something like constructive targeting or something like that, right? Because it isn't actual targeting necessarily. One can imagine a situation in which, you know, you don't have an in for religion or for a particular religious group when you're making these laws and these exceptions. You're just going about your natural regulating business, and you know there are some other constituencies whose views or whose claims seem to you particularly powerful, and they just happen not to be the religious ones.
Yeah, well, I always chuckle when I hear the word constructive. I remember a friend of mine saying in law school, whenever you see the word constructive, you should read not. So, but look, I look at it. So look, this is, you know, listeners, that Smith is controversial in part because no one is quite sure after 30 years exactly what it means. And that's another reason why critics say it should be overruled, but that didn't happen in this case. The Supreme Court reversed, as I said, unanimously, reversed the lower court, said that Catholic Social Services should win. This was a violation of the adoption agency's free exercise rights. But the court ruled on very narrow grounds, which leave Smith as the controlling law here. So Chief Justice Roberts, writing for a six-person majority, which included the court's progressives, Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan, that might be a clue as to why it was a narrow opinion, as well as Justices Kavanaugh and Barrett, concluded that the city's policy was not generally applicable, in part because the city had allowed a theoretical exception to its non-discrimination requirement, an exception in the city's quote-unquote sole discretion. Now, the city had never made an exception to the anti-discrimination requirement. It had no plans to do so. But the court said that the existence of even a theoretical exception showed that the city's policy wasn't generally applicable. And as a consequence, the rule was subject to strict scrutiny.
Now, this is one of the weird things about this case, Mark, that I haven't wrapped my arms around yet. And that is on the question of just how broad or narrow the holding is. You know, that feature of the holding seems pretty broad to me. So not just that the municipality or the state has made actual exceptions, but even the mere possibility of an exception. And then you might read, well, the mere possibility of an exception explicitly stated in the law to be made in the municipalities or in the state's sole discretion. Or maybe that's a way to kind of read it narrowly. In other words, if the state doesn't have something written into its law stating that it can make an exception, at least on theoretical grounds in its discretion, well, maybe that's a different situation than Fulton. But if simply the possibility that an exception might be made in theory on some grounds is enough to knock out a law as being not generally applicable, that does seem like a pretty broad holding. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that. I think if the court is serious about what it says, I'm not gonna, just as you say, that the existence of a theoretical exception is enough to make a law no longer generally applicable, even if the exception has never been used and is very unlikely to be used. Well, that essentially reads Smith out of the picture, because it's hard to imagine a law that doesn't admit of any exception at all. There's always going to be some exception somewhere. But you know, Mark, you and I have talked about this in past episodes. The Supreme Court's religion jurisprudence is notoriously unpredictable. And who knows what they'll make of this in the next case, that is the justices. Let's see how they read this. Okay, now let's go back to the case for a second. So the court said this city policy was not generally applicable and therefore subject to strict scrutiny, which the policy failed. Why? Because the court said, even conceding that the city had a compelling interest, and here I got to be careful because, you know, the court is very, 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 you know, cagey about this. The court actually says it's a weighty interest, not a compelling interest. Now, our listeners might say, well, what's the difference? Weighty and compelling, same thing. The test is compelling interest. And I think the court says weighty interest. Maybe they're trying to suggest something that it's really not a compelling interest. But again, we'll see what happens with that.
It reminds me of the debate over what strict scrutiny really means, and this wonderful article by Professor Michael Stokes Paulson, whose title was "Medium Rare Scrutiny," which describes the kind of scrutiny in the way that you might cook a piece of meat, right?
Yeah,
so various shadings of possibility of weight that might be assigned to a particular government interest in this case.
Well, I guess so. I'll leave aside culinary metaphors. I'm having a hard enough time with the basic metaphors that the court uses. But even assuming the city had a compelling interest in preventing discrimination generally, the fact that the city had allowed exceptions in theory for other circumstances showed that it did not have a compelling interest that justified denying an exception to Catholic social services here. Now, here again, Mark, it depends what the court makes of this in the future. If they are really saying that the possibility of any exception means that the state does not have a compelling interest with regard to any particular litigant, well, then all of these laws are going to fail strict scrutiny, because that will show there isn't a compelling interest in the individual case. Maybe that's what the court will say in the future. We'll just have to see. We should say, just to wrap up this case, that there were concurrences in this case. Justices Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch would have gone further. They would have ruled for the city, they would have ruled for Catholic social services, but they would have overruled Smith as well. And as I say, Alito's opinion looks like it was a majority opinion. It has that feel about it, but maybe he lost some votes after conference or after he circulated the opinion. Who really knows? Okay, well, that was Fulton. Let's turn now to the term that's coming up, which is going to begin in just a couple of weeks. Because, Mark, there are a couple of important cases on the court's docket for this term. One of them the court just added recently.
That's true. So we're going to talk about a couple of them. We should say that there are other very, very big cases on the court's docket that are not strictly speaking religion clause cases, but that do have to do with law and religion. And one of those, of course, is the very big abortion rights case that is coming. And probably there will be offshoots of that case, you know, other lawsuits that will be filed that may even directly implicate the religion clauses. But we're not going to talk about those cases, that set of cases in this podcast. We're really going to focus on the sort of, you could call them pure religion clause cases here, and then we might reserve those issues for a future podcast. So one very, very important case that is on the docket is one of these religious funding cases. It's called Carson versus Macon, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, M-A-K-I-N. And the issue in this case is whether a state violates the Free Exercise Clause or the Equal Protection Clause by prohibiting students from participating in what is an otherwise generally available student aid program if those students use whatever money they get from the state to attend schools that offer religious instruction or religious programs.
Now, Mark, you and I joke about this a lot. I always get confused by these cases. I always think that the court has decided this issue already. So the court just a couple of years ago had another major case involving school funding called Espinoza versus Montana Department of Revenue. How does this case differ from Espinoza?
Yeah, you're right. The degrees of difference between some of these cases, and then we'll talk about Trinity Lutheran, another case that is sort of in a similar vein. The court has been really going kind of piecemeal along with very, very specific factual distinctions in some of these cases. And they do tend to sound a little bit similar. So this case, the way that it differs from Espinoza is that it addresses a question that was technically left open by Espinoza. Because Espinoza talked about whether a state can exclude a student or school from participating in a student aid program solely because of the school's religious status. And it said, no, a state or a municipality cannot do that if the exclusion, again, is just based on the fact that there's an affiliation as a formal matter between the school and a religious organization or institution. Whereas the issue here is about whether a state can exclude a student or school from participating in one of these aid programs because of the religious use to which the money will be put. So the case really turns on the difference, if any, if there is a difference between religious status and religious use. So in terms of more specifics about the case, you know, it's a little early with respect to the case's progress. What we have right now is the petition and the brief in opposition. We don't have any of the merits briefs. But here's what we know, just sort of factually. The case comes out of Maine, and Maine has several school districts that don't operate secondary schools. So what Maine does is to offer a tuition assistance program for students in those districts. So for students in districts without a secondary school, their school districts are obligated to pay tuition up to a statutory limit at the public or approved private school of the parents and the student's choice. And those, by the way, can be inside Maine or outside Maine. They can even be in other countries. They can be anywhere. Now, up until 1980, students could attend schools defined by the statute as quote unquote sectarian. And this is a kind of a loaded term with a long history. You know, it means religious, I suppose, but it also might mean more than that. It might mean after Espinoza, it has to mean more than simply religious, because Espinoza says you can't exclude a school that is religious simply because it's religious from one of these programs. So its meaning actually after that case is not particularly clear to me. But at any rate, in 1980, an opinion of the Maine Attorney General concluded that allowing students to choose those schools and receive the tuition assistance would violate the Establishment Clause. So that understanding of the Maine AG was codified by statute, providing that the school chosen for the assistance program had to be non-sectarian, this term. Okay, right. So Maine had a school review process to determine whether a school is sectarian or not. It probes whether the school teaches its subject through a religious lens or otherwise offers religious instruction. So basically what you have in the case are a couple of families who qualify for the tuition assistance program. They want to send their children to accredited religious schools, up to Bangor Christian School in one case and to Temple Academy in another. These are both Christian private schools. You know, both of these schools are excluded by the Maine statute. And meanwhile, other schools that are nominally religious but are deemed by Maine to offer quote-unquote universal rather than quote-unquote sectarian spiritual values instruction, those are permitted to participate in Maine's program.
So it sounds like the Maine statute raises really serious entanglement problems, if nothing else. If the state of Maine has to investigate whether this is really, you know, sort of religious or not, the use to which these schools put the money.
Yeah, not just that, but they seem to be in a position where they're preferring certain kinds of religion to other kinds of religion. So because they have been forced by the Supreme Court to include nominally religious schools, where it's not like those nominally religious schools have no religious views or don't incorporate any sorts of views about religion, spirituality, morality, and so on into the curriculum. They do, and they get in, but the ones deemed sectarian don't. And so right. I think, as you said, as we said earlier, there's a kind of a complicated progressing doctrinal history just to be aware of for our readers. And the key Supreme Court cases are three. Number one, Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia versus Comer. This is a decision from 2017. We've actually talked about this decision in former podcasts. This decision held that the Free Exercise Clause prohibits government from denying what are otherwise available public benefits on the basis of religious status. So that's a sort of a government benefit case. Then Espinoza, the case that we just talked about from a year ago, actually, which says that the Free Exercise Clause prohibits government from barring a religious school's participation in an elementary and secondary tuition assistance program, again, on the basis of religious status. And then the third case actually is a very interesting case from 2004, a little bit older, called Locke versus Davy, where the Supreme Court upheld a state's exclusion of devotional theology majors from a state's, in this case, Washington State's undergraduate scholarship program. So that's an undergraduate program. It did seem, I think, to make a kind of distinction between status and use. But anyways, taking all of these cases together, the First Circuit ruled for Maine. It said, look, you know, neither Trinity Lutheran nor Espinoza involved the issue of religious use, only religious status. So the formal affiliation of the school. And as to religious use, the First Circuit said, what the school teaches and how it presents its material, its quote unquote religious inculcation, when we're dealing with those issues, Locke is the controlling precedent.
But I see a way to distinguish Locke. If I remember Locke, Locke was about someone training to be a member of the clergy. And so the court might say, well, yes, we're going to uphold Locke. We're not going to overrule Locke. Locke says you can't use public funds to train to be a member of the clergy. But that's not really what's going on here. So it sounds to me, I haven't boned up on this case. I'm not so clear with the details. But it seems to me, just from the way you're describing it, that this Maine statute is going to be declared unconstitutional, and they can leave, given what the drift of the court seems to be in these other cases, and they can leave Locke on the books as relating only to training of clergy.
Yeah, I think that would be a very clean way. And in fact, Locke does really talk about this is really quite different and so on. Whereas these religious schools that we're talking about, they're not in the business of training people for the clergy. These are high schools. These are high schools that are otherwise quote unquote regular high schools that happen to teach from a particular religious perspective and point of view. So that's one kind of issue involves these considerations that we're talking about. How will the court negotiate its prior precedents? And frankly, Mark, I agree with you. I think given the direction of the court, given its new members and so on, I wonder what's going to happen to the Maine statute. But another issue is that having drawn this distinction between use and status, the First Circuit also held that the appropriate level of scrutiny for these kinds of distinctions based on use isn't strict scrutiny, as the Supreme Court has said in Trinity Lutheran and Espinoza, that it is when we're dealing with status, but instead rational basis scrutiny, which the First Circuit said, look, the statute easily survives rational basis scrutiny because of the state's interests in avoiding religious entanglement. So this, you can see, you know, you mentioned, you know, the state seems to be involved in getting itself mixed up in religious entanglements. Well, here the actual justification for making the distinction in the first place was exactly to avoid religious entanglements. So it's a kind of an entangled set of doctrines involving the Establishment Clause. And it's sort of... one thing that occurs to me is how these questions of what entanglement means really depends on one's perspective about what is and is not problematic from a constitutional point of view. Mm-hmm. So the petitioner's claims really in this case are A, you know, as often happens, you know, cert petition, you've got to make a circuit split kind of claim, and there is a circuit split on the issue of whether there's really a distinction between status and use. By the way, Mark, if you'll remember, in the Trinity Lutheran case, Justice Gorsuch, in a concurrence, really expressed some strong reservations about whether this distinction holds up. Right. And you know, right, whether A, conceptually, there's really a difference between, you know, does... the line was something like, if you remember, does a religious man sit down to dinner, or does a man sit down to dinner to exercise, or, you know, with a view toward exercising his religion, right? I mean, it's, yeah, you know, it's sort of, you know, it's a little bit, the distinction is a little bit like sand, right? Like holding sand. So that's one thing. And then another thing, apart from the conceptual distinction, is the issue of the kind of burden that you impose on many of these religious institutions if you really make it so that they can't express or exercise any of their religion in carrying out their functions, well, you're imposing a pretty substantial burden on their religious free exercise.
Okay, so that's one big case coming up, and we'll keep an eye on that for our listeners. But then there's another case that I just granted last week, actually, a case called Ramirez versus Collier, which is a prison case under a statute called ARLUPA, and also I guess the free exercise clause is implicated here too. And here the issue is whether a prisoner is entitled to the presence of his minister, his clergy member, who would lay hands on him and pray for him and offer words of comfort in the execution chamber while the prisoner is being executed. The state of Texas doesn't allow this to occur, although it does allow a member of the clergy to be in the room in the execution chamber and pray silently. So Mark, we should say there have been very similar cases that have come up before this in the last couple of years.
Yeah, that's right. There have been other cases about just what it is that the state has to provide in the execution chamber. You know, as you say, this is a RLUIPA case. What Texas allows is for the minister to be in the room, the execution chamber room, but kind of, you know, off to the side and not to say anything. You know, the RLUIPA standard
let me just interrupt you for a second, Mark. Just so RLUIPA is the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. It is a statute that was passed in the wake of Employment Division versus Smith. It applies only in limited contexts, and it restores the strict scrutiny test that Smith had abolished or had departed from.
Yeah, that's very helpful, Mark. I should have done that also. And actually, for even a little bit more detail, what had happened was that RFRA was passed in the wake of Smith and then was struck down in a later case with respect to its application against the states. And in the wake of that case, Congress got together and passed this statute specifically for land use and prison matters. And that one did survive a kind of federalism challenge from the states in a later case. So that's what this case is dealing with. It's obviously a case with a lot of sort of emotional sort of components swirling around it, the death penalty, what people are entitled to in their last moments, and so on. Again, I tend to think Texas is going to have a heavy lift in fending off the claims of prisoners who would like some kinds of a more active spiritual ministration from their ministers or clergy in the execution chambers. Their defense, which is the usual defense that prisons mount, is based on security concerns and so on. We'll just have to see how the facts bear that out or not.
Yeah, I see. Okay, so we have a couple of important cases coming up, and you know, we didn't even address in this podcast the COVID cases. We've talked about them in past episodes. Maybe we'll do another one on the COVID cases at some point, because they don't seem to be entirely gone away just yet. But for now, this has been another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on our website, lawandreligionforum.org. And also on Apple iTunes and also on Android. So we'll be back with more episodes now that the school year has begun again. And we hope you'll join us for all of those in the future. Meanwhile, see you next time.